Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. Today we're discussing Three Body Problem, the Netflix show written by D.B. Weiss, David Benioff, and Alexander Wu, which was adapted from the novel by Liu Zhizing. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, we're cousins who love to explore the worlds of fantasy and sci-fi shows. In the past, we've discovered the multiverse of His Dark Materials, examined the bending of Avatar The Last Airbender, and The Legend of Korra, analyzed the monster slaying of The Witcher, and navigated the conflicts of House of the Dragon. You can find our previous coverage in your podcast feeds.
We're pretty hyped to dive into this new story with you as we explore the increasingly chaotic world of the Oxford Five. These guys are a mess.
Hot mess.
Just all over the place. We'll be discussing the first four episodes of the series, and we'll have some light spoilers for the book up until the point where episode four ends. But we will not be spoiling anything from episodes 5 through 8 or future events in the book series. If you haven't seen the episodes yet, go watch them and come back once you've caught up.
And Kinfolk, we won't leave you hanging while you're trying to figure out the countdown and your whole life by sleeping on a stoop after a night of tripping off our balls. By literally and figuratively doing that, we will have adult content. But you know, you'll need that because you need it like Saul needs coffee, conversation, and to pick the grass out of his beer. Because
on the woman's doorstep.
What is wrong with him? Oh my gosh. Let's go. Let's get into it.
He continues to be a mess through the rest of the season.
Ridiculous.
All right. So we're going to move through the summary by sort of narrative plot lines, not in exact order. So first, let's talk about what happened in China in 1966. In Beijing, physicist Ye Zhatai was publicly murdered for advancing the Big Bang Theory in front of an excited crowd by the Red Guards. And we'll talk a little bit about who the Red Guards are later. His daughter, Ye Wenjie, who is also a student of his, is found mourning him and sent to a work camp. At the camp, she discovers love, which was, you know, her first mistake, and a book called Silent Spring by an American writer named Rachel Carson. Because she is found in possession of this book, Wenjie finds herself in a difficult position. She must either await trial or accept a posting at a secret military base where she can never leave for the rest of her life. She accepts and soon learns that the Chinese government is attempting to send messages into space in the hopes of communicating with another planet. She comes up with the idea to use the sun to amplify the signal. 8 years pass, and Wenjie receives a frantic response from a pacifist of another people on another planet, saying not to respond or their people will come and conquer Earth. She sends a response. Wow. Come, we cannot save ourselves.
But they said nothing about saving. Tough. He's begging. He's like, please, do not respond to this. Stop. Stop what the fuck you're doing, okay? So let's talk about some of the strange things that happened. All right. In present day, London Oxford grad Augie Salazar is on the verge of opening her nanotechnology company when she learns from her friend Jin Chung that none of the major particle accelerators in the world are getting results that make any sense. Jin tells Augie that she and fellow Oxford grad Saul Duran have been looking into the phenomenon and have yet to figure it out. Shortly after learning this, Augie begins to see a countdown in her vision. The final countdown! Augie, Jin, and Saul learn that their former mentor from Oxford, Verrier, has committed suicide. At her funeral, they are reunited with two of their classmates. First, teacher Will Downing and Snack Empire King, Jack Rooney, a.k.a. Samwell Tarly.
He's doing well.
He is.
He's doing come well up. After his, you know, becoming the Grand Maester. Like, he's doing well. He left the Maester chain behind and said, you know, snacks is where that. I see hot pie doing the most, making his little pies.
Switching places with Hot Pie. Oh my gosh, great. I love it. After the funeral, a woman approaches Augie and tells her to stop her research or else. She tells Augie to look into the sky at midnight the next day to see the universe blink. The entire world sees the stars in the sky disappear and reappear in an apparent countdown. Just as her company is about to start up production on nanotech, Augie shuts it down so that she can stop the countdown that's happening in her vision. While all this weird stuff is happening, an investigator named Clarence, also known as Dashi, from an unknown agency, is looking into the strange happenings with special attention on the Oxford Five and the deaths of 30 scientists worldwide.
All right, let's talk about the game, because that's what this whole thing is about.
It's a whole ad for Oculus. Oculus is out here.
So Jin visits Vera's mother after the funeral and is given a headset for a game that Vera was playing. Jin and Jack play the game together and eventually figure out that the goal of the game is to save the people of a doomed planet. Once they understand this, they're invited to meet with the same woman who threatened Augie. And at the meeting, they go into level 4 of the game, where an AI tells them that there's no solution to a three-body problem and shows them that the only chance for survival of the people of this doomed planet is to find a new home. Jack believes it is a scam and leaves angrily, and later that evening, he is killed by the same woman who seems to just be appearing everywhere. Jin, however, once she finds out that Jack has been murdered, accepts the invitation to the summit to help Dashi and his boss, Thomas Wade, a.k.a. Davos.
He's always
Hand
like...
of the King to both Jon Snow and Bran the Broken.
He's
Folks,
always...
if you're not getting it, there will be lots of Thrones references.
Oh my gosh, it couldn't be any other way with the showrunners and the people they cast, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, like, he's always rounding up ships and gathering the troops. I mean, this is who he is. Anyway.
At the summit, it is revealed that Ye Wenje is the leader of the followers of the Santi, which is the alien group that is threatening to invade. Before she is arrested, she tells the crowd that the Santi will arrive in approximately 400 years.
Crazy good start to this show. I am excited to talk about some of the noteworthy things, some of the context to this. There's so much to unpack in what we just said. It's going to be a journey, y'all. Like, I really think that this is going to be a pretty cool show. I hope they get renewed, but let's talk about it. What's some of the things that we want to talk about from, like, giving, let's just set the context for this moment in history, starting with China 1966.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to do this because the author of the book was writing from that starting point. Mm-hmm. This book series is about Earth, right? But I think mm-hmm. in the concept of his point of view is a Chinese citizen. Mm-hmm. And so obviously as a Chinese citizen, his world experience is based upon something that happened in the recent history of China, which was a cultural revolution. And so many people may know this already, but I think I need a refresher because I had not studied anything involving China's history since I was in high school. I don't even mm-hmm. think we touched on it in college. Like, I remember Western Civ, which mm-hmm. is obviously leaves China out. As I said, it was the Cultural Revolution, which was initiated by Mao Zedong, which is a favorite of the Republican Party to bring up. He is the founding father of the People's Republic of China, and his whole aim was to revitalize Chinese socialism by purging the remnants of capitalist and traditional elements from Chinese society. So this is really important because this is the ideology under which the Red Guards, these young people who murder Ye Wenji's father, mm-hmm. this is the ideology by which they live. So the Red Guards were predominantly composed of high school and university students, but also included, like, you know, young workers and peasants. They were fervent supporters of Mao and his revolutionary communist ideology. They were known for their zealous devotion, and they created all kinds of paramilitary groups, counterculture movements. They conducted mass rallies and engaged in violent campaigns against the perceived enemies of the revolution, which means they targeted intellectuals, bureaucrats, educators, anyone that they deemed to be bourgeoisie or counter-revolutionary. This led to widespread chaos and violence and the total breakdown of social order in China. So this is the moment that we're entering this story, this moment of fear, this moment where just for being a thinker of any kind, people are being persecuted. And I think really importantly, something we didn't mention in the summary, which is that Ye Wenji's mother turned on her father in order to survive, in order to live, so that she could live. They actually have two daughters in the book, and her, it's understood that her other daughter also turned on her father. Like, everyone took that moment to survive and to do what they could to maintain their humanity, but at the same time they betrayed the father. And in some ways I wonder, like, was it even worth, you know, like, was it worth it betraying him, you know?
I mean,
like,
yeah,
it seemed like he was going to probably die no matter what if he didn't relent and say that the Big Bang theory was a total hoax. Like, he probably would have died anyway.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, even if, does he live if he says that it wasn't a hoax? Like, I mean, like, there were things that were being asked here that were impossible, like, for him to answer. Like, you know, are you denying the presence of God? Like, all these things that he was like, there's no proof for or against. Like, that, it was... Do you think he lives? I don't know. I guess I wonder.
I think he would have survived, like, physically, but whether or not he would have survived intellectually and emotionally, because what would have happened to him is he would have turned against other science. They would have used him to turn against other intellectuals and scientists. So it, either way, he suffers a kind of death. And I think that's what, in reading about what happened during the Cultural Revolution, like, that is what I think we're meant to understand, is that either way, it's a kind of death, that either you die as a person that you, with integrity that you are, and have to deny everything you believe in, or you die physically, end your life. And so I think he understood that, and he made a choice. But the way that, like, this should have never happened. You can disagree with people, obviously not getting violent against them. And, you know, we have our own dark history. Not so long before this, we were also persecuting people for thinking differently because we thought they were communists. So it's like...
No, for sure.
So I just think it's important because, like, to set the context, just because as Americans, not that we forget this happened, but I don't think this, the way that European history plays an outsized role in our worldview, this is the worldview and the most recent, like, major event that was completely society changing that the author's coming from. Like, this is the root of so much of what he is trying to relay in the book. This moment created the trauma that created this whole problem and conflict within the story, three body problem.
I guess the thing that comes up for me in a question is, I don't know that it's answered, you know, in these four episodes, but I guess I'm wondering whether or not, like, what is the Red Guard getting at here? Are they trying to prove, like, you know, kind of like more religious thought in some ways? I know they're trying to remove, like, Western thought, and, like, this is being said because of Einstein's connectivity to the theory of relativity and how that plays into the Big Bang theory, and trying to just remove that. But once that's removed, what's the replacement theory for, like, how the world began?
Right. I mean, I don't think that the show makes it clear. I don't recall the book making it clear either. Mm-hmm. But I think that the problem they have with the Big Bang Theory is actually that it allows for the existence of a god. Because yeah. It doesn't say, you know, like either way, like their notion is that there must have been a creator before that, right? Which is not what science is saying. Which is kind of like ironic.
Yeah, exactly. That if you're saying that there is a beginning, then it has to be something before it that created it in order for there to be a beginning. And then also, you know, and really what you know, I just think that it's interesting to see them trying to remove this, but not really give any, and I don't really hear the offering up, at least in the story is what I'm saying. Like, I don't know about historically, but in the story, not offering up, well, okay, let's get rid of that theory because this is how it really happened. I don't know through some reading and research that Mao's mother was more of a practicing Buddhist from what I've read. So
which
I don't know.
Which is interesting because yeah. I think there's some interesting stuff in this story that I'm not sure if is intentionally pulled from Buddhism, but I think it's certainly represented there.
Yeah. He would, you know, and it's interesting because I know that there's a lot of like reading that he abandoned the faith, like Mao did in real life. Like he was in his, like as he got older, he abandoned that he abandoned Buddhism as his faith. But who knows? You know, we weren't there. But I do think like that is something interesting to examine, like this conflict between, and we'll talk about that more as we get deeper into it. But I think when you're looking at the context of this story, what's truly fascinating to me is that she's given this book while at this camp that is really a pivotal book when it comes to environmental science, right? A book written by Rachel Carson in 1962 called Silent Spring. It's widely regarded as one of the most influential books of the 20th century and played a significant role in launching the modern environmental movement. The book's central theme revolves around the detrimental effects of pesticides, particularly DDT, on the environment, wildlife, and human health. Carson warned against the indiscriminate use of pesticides and highlighted their long-term ecological consequences. In preparation for the pod, I was reading a little bit about some of this, and I found it fascinating that how she discovered it. She was seeing planes just kind of like, you know, dropping these chemicals in her area and became really intrigued by what was going on. Why were they doing this in these residential areas? And she wanted to know where people were growing their food and things were happening. And through that, really became an activist that a lot of the environmental movement was based off of. What do you think about the significance of this?
So I think that this, I have so many feelings about this. I've never read this book.
Me either.
But when I Googled the book when I was reading Three Body Problem, I was immediately had a moment of like, oh, this is an American cultural touch point. Like, I remember even in the 90s, the lawsuits and outrage about DDT. Mm-hmm. This book still, 30 years later, was making waves in American culture and politics. And what I think is most important, because the three-body problem, neither the show nor the book gives us any real idea of what's in this book.
Silent Spring, yeah.
Like, it just kind of dropped in there. But that, in nature, nothing exists alone. The interconnectedness between all species, plants, animals, humans, all important. And that, I think, is what we're supposed to draw from it. I mean, that quote, in nature, nothing exists alone, is said at least three times in this show. And I think that's what we're supposed to pull from it, which is like, this book is about Earth, and it's about how using pesticides to kill insects is actually harmful to all kinds of wildlife, humans, the air, the water, you know, sea life, everything. And I think what we're supposed to draw from it is that Ye Wen Zhe and I forget the sparrow's name. The Heist Brown's name.
Oh God, what is his name? Hold on.
Mike Evans.
Yeah. I feel it's a guy.
Mm-hmm. So I think that what we're supposed to draw from it is that Ye Wenjie and Mike Evans are pulling from it a larger meaning, which is that Earth is just like one ecosystem. What if we think bigger about this? What if we think about the whole universe? Like, nothing in nature exists alone.
And is this kind of like conversation that they have, right? When they go to build another site for a satellite, and she says that quote, which is a quote from Rachel Carson, right? And so she says that quote, and then he kind of like is taken aback, but kind of like intrigued by her using that quote, and he's there on an environmentalist mission. So I almost wonder if he knew the quote and knew who she was referencing, and that kind of connected them in that way. I picked that up only after finding out more about where the quote came from, and I wonder what you thought. Did you think that this was kind of like a reference point for both of them?
I think she saw the book when they visited him. Because she said it to him then too. So I think she saw the quote when, I mean, sorry, she saw the book when she visited, although having watched that scene twice, I didn't quite clock when she saw it. I think it's a little, this is a problem with subtitles I always have, is I'm trying to read for the dialogue. I sometimes miss the larger scene. And some of this scene was in Chinese, so I needed the subtitles. But I think that I think that this was a common understanding between the two of them, this the thesis of this book. And I think she's used, when they meet in the 70s, I believe, she's using it to kind of hint to him that there was something bigger going on than, you know, she initially alluded to when they first met. So I thought it was an interesting tie-in, because it was kind of something that connected them, drew on their previous meeting, but also relates to her kind of thesis in life, which is that, you know, there's something else out there. We're not alone, which I think is like the whole reason humans explore space. Are we alone? You know, like I think so. I thought that was a great use of connecting the book, even though I really wish the show and the source material would have done a better job of telling us what was in this book.
Yeah, no question. Yeah, maybe it's an Easter egg. He wants us to go try to read the book. I'm interested now a little bit. Like, now
I am too. I've definitely considered, like, do I want to read this book? Do I want to read do I want to read something that is more contemporary, right? Because there's been so much research now on pesticides. Like, I think some of our listeners will have just sort of grown up with organic food. Like that, like just finding that in supermarkets, just having Whole Foods in their town or in their city. Like that was something that transition happened in our lives. And I think this book had a lot to do with that.
Yeah. I'm definitely interested in checking it out. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I am thinking also just about the parallels in a lot of ways between potentially she's connecting with Mike Evans, and then whoever this pacifist is, she's connected with that pacifist, and her willingness to like connect with this extraterrestrial that's warning her in a sense of like, hey, let them come because like we can't save ourselves. I ultimately see some parallels between both worlds that she's in the middle of. I see some parallels between how she's experiencing her life there and also what potentially she's engaging in with the extraterrestrials. I see like the fact that mysteriously somehow there's these countdowns happening. Who's causing that? What's happening? Like, is there some sort of like oppressive regime doing that beyond this? And that's what it gives you the impression of by this mysterious woman that keeps showing up, that either someone that's with with Mike Evans or somebody else is like the extraterrestrials are doing this, you know?
Yeah, I don't think at this point in the show it's clear who's doing what. Like, I think we have the notion that the game is at least controlled to some extent by the followers.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see them watching the game and we see them, you know, like they're collecting data. The mysterious woman whose name is Tatiana, she tells us that when Jack and Jin go to meet with her, mm-hmm. that they're collecting biometric data. So clearly they have some control. I guess my question is about this game, like who developed it? How did it get here? How is Mike Evans talking to aliens? Like before they had to wait 8 years to get a response. And then suddenly, I guess they developed technology where they could speak more freely and openly and instantaneously in a conversational way. It makes me really curious about the Santee. Like, who are they? Like, what their technology seems so advanced.
I mean, they make multiple references to that, right? That the Santee's technology, that they don't call them the Santee, but they say this technology is at least 20 years, 20 or more years, maybe even more than that.
Yeah, Jack says it's 150 years out. Like, yeah. Very specific. Oh, wait, actually, I think that was Augie was like, we don't have this and we will not have this anytime soon. Like, so how did it get made and distributed? I have questions about that. And maybe that stuff isn't that important to this story, but I do think it's interesting.
And I think that it's the parallel I'm drawing is that by this point in the story, I believe that we're pretty clear that somebody's offing scientists, right? Whether that is being controlled by the followers or somebody greater, that scientists are offing themselves. And or they're, you know, we see in Jack's case, he's killed by this lady. So they're killing people who are connected to scientists, threats to like sharing the message, scientists themselves. The very first suicide we see is a prominent scientist. They want her to shut down the nanotech lab, the followers. And I think that that's the parallel I'm drawing to like this idea of removing, you know, the stories around the Big Bang Theory and the you know, theory of relativity and all these other things. And, you know, Silent Spring being a you know, kind of like revolutionary text. This to me feels very like there's a parallel there to be like the suppression of information and removal of information to suit a narrative, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's other parallels too. And I think that actually Yewen Jay actually sees these as a positive thing, which is mm-hmm. the Santee have a chaotic world, much like the world that we have on Earth. But it's their physical world that's mm-hmm. chaotic. It's this, like what they call a chaotic error mm-hmm. That they can't control. But despite that, they have advanced. Now, I have a lot of questions about why she assumes that they've advanced into some like amazing society mm-hmm. that isn't violent, doesn't have its own revolutionary moment. Like in the game, if we're to draw conclusions, like the game is actually quite violent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know how she makes this leap, but she seems to think like the Santee will be able to save us because their physical environment is trying to destroy them and they keep persevering. Whereas we have a fairly stable physical environment and we're destroying it and each other. But she makes a lot of leaps here. Like, I'm just like, agreed. I don't... I have to say that when I got to the part of the book where she responds, I was literally stunned.
Yeah.
I was like, what just happened? Like, why would she respond? Like, this guy's, well, we don't know if it's we don't even know if they have gender. So I'm just going to say this alien is telling you that your people will be conquered and you're like, come. Now, we can talk a little bit about why I think she made that decision at that point.
Well, let's talk about it. Why do you think so? Like, why do you think so?
I think this comes off of her conversation with the Red Guard. Right? I think that watching her father being murdered was a truly horrific moment that she is still trying to understand and comprehend. Several years pass, and she's found a life that she actually kind of can live with, right? She can't leave this military base really ever. She has to live there forever, but she's found camaraderie. She loves the science. She's found something that she's found a livable life. When her colleague tells her that the Red Guard is in the work camp and she goes to see her, I think what she's expecting is like a moment of closure. Mm-hmm. Like this, she sees her. This is a young woman who has had her arm amputated. She sees that she's living a miserable life. And what she expects is things have changed. Now the Red Guards are being suppressed and put into work camps. Now this young woman must understand that what she did was so horrible. She is now an oppressed person, just like my father was an oppressed person. And she's expecting a moment of, I didn't know what I was doing. I was a child when I did it. And instead she says that she would scythe him again. The almost making the whole trip, the whole conversation, this whole moment meaningless. Like, you're sitting here expecting me to repent. I would do it all again, even knowing the outcome. Because despite having had my own people turn on me, I still don't see anything wrong. And I think for her, she's seeing a world that created a young woman like that with that kind of mindset cannot be saved. Yeah. That this world that has created that kind of cruelty cannot be saved. And that's why she does it. It's still, I'm still like, but what, you're making a lot of leaps here in terms of who you're speaking to. But I can understand that worldview, that believing that anything, any culture that creates that kind of, that takes someone's humanity from them can't be saved. I can understand that worldview. I don't agree with it, but I can understand it. But I still find what she did completely wild. Like, I was like, wait, what are we doing? We're telling the aliens to come get us?
Yeah, I mean, because to me, you become exactly, you almost like give up on the thing that you're fighting for. Like, she's kind of had another, I feel like that was a transformed worldview. Like, she gave up hope in that moment, you know, a little bit. And you know, but she gave up hope and then believed in another ideology that still requires us to remove scientists and thought and thing from another vantage point.
I know. So it's like a little, that's the part that I struggle with. If what we watched, sorry to interrupt you, but I don't want to lose this because I think you're saying the same thing. If what we watched is actually her villain origin story, and she was just like, burn it all down. Let's say that she's Daenerys and in the season we do not speak about. if that's what we were watching, then I could say, yeah, that makes sense. Fine, burn it all down. Like, that's a totally valid point of view in her circumstances. Again, I don't agree with it, but I get it, right? They've taken everything from her. And then she can't even get like even the slightest contrition from this woman who killed her father. Like, that I could see, but it's clear that she actually thinks that the Santee are going to do something about this condition. And that's the part that I don't understand from her, is like, how did you, I can understand if you're like, burn it all down, but what I don't understand is the thinking they're going to actually save us.
Yeah, it's the part that I'm not really getting, but it made me think. It made me think about an old Cherokee poem called "The Wolf You Feed." And many people have probably heard this in different formats, but it's about an old Cherokee man telling his grandson about, you know, his outlook on life, about having these two wolves inside of him, and that, you know, it's a battle that goes on and rages inside of him between these two wolves. One is evil and angry. The other one is jealous. The one is evil, angry, jealous, and has greed, regret, and sorrow, and arrogance. And the other one is good. It's full of joy, peace, love, and hope, and kindness, and benevolence. And the grandson hears the whole story, and he asks, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he asks basically, well, which wolf wins? And he says, the one you feed. And I think, like, that's the battle that she's in. She's chosen to feed this new wolf, thinking that it is good. But it may not be any better than the one that was already being fed, right? So there's, like, there's some interpretations to me about that story that's about your own idea of morality. And you know, in a lot of these extremes of good and evil, right and wrong, black and white, you often find that there's, like, this, and we'll get into some of, like, the mysticism versus science, but you often find that there is, in fact, to your idea about Buddhism, the middle way. There is, in fact, an equilibrated approach that doesn't negate, that doesn't feed either the way that is being described even in that Cherokee poem. You know what I mean? So I think, like, there's some interesting things that she's feeding into a brand new kind of, like, thing, thinking that, and, like, often, I think, how many times have we watched recently in these Netflix specials about all these cults where people just want to buy into something that they believe in so fervently that's better than the world that they exist in, only to find out that it's the exact same world they exist in with more fuckery. You know what I mean? Like, and it's very fascinating how we look for things outside of ourselves to validate the pain inside of ourselves. And I don't know that that ever works, you know?
Yeah, I think that's part of the sort of moral of the story here is that we live in a chaotic world, but, like, we're all seeking to find a way to kind of mitigate that chaos. And perhaps this was her way. I still think this is a wild leap. I'm just like, what were you thinking? And, like, it, even when she's arrested and she's like, our Lord will do this, and our Lord, I'm just like, you sound crazy. Like, you've got to know that you are fanatic. Like, that what's happening here.
If any of our listeners or you yourself have watched Wild Wild Country on Netflix, I mean, it's possible. Like, this happens to real human beings.
Wait, was Wild Wild Country on Netflix or HBO?
It was on Netflix. It was totally on Netflix. Wild Wild Country is one of the craziest, like, I've seen that and been like, yo, this is nuts.
Because HBO and Netflix are both engaged in, like, here's a new cult today. And sometimes they have dueling documentaries, and I'm like, I will watch them both.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah,
it's totally a cult. And yeah. I don't want to, like, harp on this point. I still just don't understand her total thinking, but maybe that will become clear in the later episode.
Do you think she, part of it is this idea that we keep hearing inside of the game, if one of us survives, we all survive? Is this, like, part of why she's, like, bought in like that?
Well, actually, no, right? I don't think so. I think these are two separate themes. In nature, nothing exists alone. And mm-hmm. if one of us survives, we all survive. Those are two separate themes.
I
and I think the if one of us survives, we all survive is some kind of foreshadowing. Now, I have read the first book of this series. I have not finished the trilogy. I believe it's a trilogy. I have not finished it. So I don't, I'm saying that totally as speculation. But it feels foreshadowing to me. Like, is it going to get to a conflict where there are only a few humans left and that's enough? Or is that simply putting us in the minds of the Santee who left the vast majority of their population on their planet to be destroyed? And then at some point, will this story get to a conflict where in the fight between humans and the Santee, if we ever get 400 years in the future, I don't think this mm-hmm. story is going that far ahead. Mm-hmm. At least the Netflix series. I don't know if the book makes it to that point, but the Netflix series, I feel like they introduced us to this Oxford Five because they want us to be invested in these particular characters.
Yeah, for sure.
But does it get to a point where there's an opportunity to destroy all the Santee and someone hesitates because of that? Like, is Jin going to be part of a conversation where it's like, we can wipe them all out and save our own people? And Jin is like, wait, all of them? Like,
yeah, that is possible.
Like, but like, Jin has this emotional connection to the follower in the game. And is she going to have a moment where she has to make that decision of like, do we destroy every single Santee, or do we allow maybe the pacifists amongst them to survive? You know, like, I think, and maybe I'm too much into like the MCU, because I feel like this is a question the MCU would definitely want to tackle. Like, yeah. I could see Captain Marvel having this exact conversation.
Yeah.
But it's an interest. I think it's foreshadowing. I think that that's what that phrase is supposed to be. We're going to get to a point where it's like, either the Santee are going to have to decide, is it okay to wipe out all humans? Or humans are going to decide, is it okay to wipe out all Santee?
I mean, and the other piece within that, agreeing with what you're saying, that came up for me was, I just thought about the actual mechanics of, if one of us survives, we all survive. And the fact that if one living organism survives, the only way for everyone to survive is to carry on that legacy and also that reproductive cycle. And so does this indicate that the Santee can multiply without a partner? That they can actually become, that if one lives, that organism continues to grow and multiply more than, because the human, that's not the case. If one of us survives, we don't all survive. That person dies and that's it. So I wonder if there's some foreshadowing there as well, where there's like the idea that reproduction of the Santee as a species does not require multiple versions of them.
I hadn't even thought of that. I think that's a really astute observation. Yeah. That's very possible.
So I'm interested in seeing where this goes. By the way, I know we kind of skirted over this before we move on to the game, because I think it's important to go to the game. But I do want to say that the opening scene of this whole entire thing started like they decided just to skip and fast forward to episode 9 of Game of Thrones and be like, let's bring him to Ned Stark getting his head chopped off and the whole thing with the screaming crowds. I just want to say that. Just out the gate. I was like, wait a second. So Ned's just getting head cut off in the beginning of this whole series now. And like, you know, our protagonist, she's like Arya Stark. Arya Stark went totally bad and never had a redemption arc back from the other. It's like crazy to me. I was looking at this like, this is episode 9. Anyway, it's funny.
That is actually interesting that it's a very similar scene. Yeah. And that then we have the potential like villain origin story of the daughter. Like, there's quite a few things like that I think they definitely learned from adapting Game of Thrones
for sure series.
And we should talk more about that in our second episode when we won't veer into spoiler territory.
I just love it's like they're like yeah we need a cult leader, how about let's get the High Sparrow, let's do that right now. Get him. He's fine.
We need a guy who's going to keep us organized. Get us Davos.
Yeah. The Onion Knight.
Same guy is going to convince people to go into danger for inexplicable reasons. Yeah, Davos seems right.
They were like mythical, magical creature that threatens somebody, and it becomes a continuing theme. We'll do that, except this time we'll kill Samwell Tarly. Totally different. You know what I mean? Yeah. Oh man, no, but it's good. I mean, honestly, like, it's really good. I love it. So let's talk about the game. Let's talk about what happens in this game, because I think, you know, it's very funny. Speaking of like, you know, period pieces, historical settings, fantasy worlds, they start this game with Jin in a Chinese historical setting and Jack in medieval England. So they're very clear that they're going to, this is definitely like people with context about our world, right?
Yeah, I love this. And Jin and Jack actually note this when they join the game together. Because Jin initially went to a Chinese historical setting and Jack went to medieval England. And then they both land back in England. And so I thought it was interesting that the Santee know enough about us that they understand that, like, they would have those cultural touch points, and that they should have in the game, they should be dealing with people who look like them, who have similar, like, even though very old, cultural understandings. I thought that was cool.
I mean, I'm really interested in this, like, iris recognition of multiplayer action games. Like, it's really crazy. Like, they were like, yes, now it's multiplayer. It is not individual. Like, I was like, wow, how did you figure that out? It's really cool. And they're both in each other's worlds and can see each other. It's pretty cool. That was a cool part to me. It was like,
yeah, the fact that he just put on his helmet and she put on hers and they were just there together was so cool.
Yeah.
I really like the stuff in the game. It's interesting because in the book I found that sometimes the parts of the game were really boring because they spend a lot of time in the game trying to figure out this three-body problem. And sometimes it's interesting and sometimes I'm like, I can't visualize this. So I'm a little disconnected from the story. These are also the very heavily science-y parts of the book. So I loved how they visualized this game. I thought that this was really cool because I didn't know what to expect. I was super worried about dehydration and rehydration, which I spoke to our friend Alyssa about because I was like, this is weird. Like, how are they going to make this work? It's still super weird and it looks crazy, but it works for the most part.
It's like a good, like, Aveeno commercial. Like, they, like, went crazy heavy. They were like, let's rehydrate them. Throw them inside some stuff. Have everybody come alive.
Oh, a lady's skincare line.
Yeah. We're going to use that. We're going to use it. Oh, man. No, it's good. I really thought it looked great, too. I really think the way that they make each level kind of give the characters, like, you know, Jin and Jack are both, like, really gaining information as they progress in the game. Jin more so, like, she's really leading this. And I thought it was fascinating that when they went into the game together that she had already figured out, oh, the real issue here is that this is, this is a three-body problem. Like, this is what's going on. What's happening in this game? Like, kind of like, let's talk about chaotic errors and stable errors.
Yeah, so science was never my strong suit in school, so I had no idea what a three-body problem was. I had heard of it as a concept before, but I didn't know what it was. So the problem in the game, which is also the problem in the home planet of the Santee, is that they have three suns pulling their planet into their gravitational field. And you cannot predict how the suns are going to move because it's very difficult to predict, actually, I believe impossible to predict for any length of time the movement of three bodies. So in the chaotic errors, the planet is floating through the gravitational field of all three suns. So it's like kind of bouncing around between the suns. In the stable errors, it is in the gravitational pull of just one of the three bodies. So they have just one sun, which is why when they're in, I guess, medieval England, it was when they're talking to the Pope in a very fiery Targaryen-like scene, all three suns, they're having this this thing where basically, like, all three suns are aligned together, are close to the planet, and so the planet burns up. It gets pulled into one of the suns.
Is Isaac Newton in these, by the way? Was it one of those people, Isaac Newton? Or was he not?
I thought Jack's name was Isaac Newton.
Jack's name, her name was Copernicus.
I guess, right.
And his name was it Isaac Newton?
I don't remember. Isaac Newton was definitely represented somewhere. But, oh, he was Thomas More, wasn't he? Or Thomas... Yeah, I think he was Thomas More. I do feel like one of the other scientists was Isaac Newton.
But the reason
I think that was a scientist who built the computer.
That's it. And that's why I found it. That is the scientist that built the computer in that sun. And the reason why I'm asking is because when I was looking up, getting ready for the episode, one of the things that I found on the wiki and some other texts was that Isaac Newton was the person who raised the three-body problem as a potential issue. Like, he was the first person to bring that up. So I thought it was just a cool nod that they brought him up somewhere.
Yeah, in this is directly from the book. In the book, all of the scientists have the names of ancient scientists, philosophers. I think, like, even one of them is, one of the Americans is, like, Galileo or something mm-hmm. like that. Like, they, in I think while we're talking about the game, it's really important, too, to note that the show is using the Oxford Five to immediately bring in a global perspective, right? Because mm-hmm. you've got the two Englishmen, you've got Will and Jack. Saul and Augie, I believe, are both American. Mm-hmm. And then you have Jin, who is Chinese and then grew up, I think, in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And so in the game is the only place where you meet people who are not Chinese. It's the only time that we're taken out of China is the main setting. Mm. So I thought it was really clever how the showrunners, they took that global perspective from the beginning, because obviously this is a problem that cannot be solved by a single country. Mm-hmm. So it is going to become a global conflict. But I liked that they kind of wrapped in all of, you know, not all of, but many major countries right away. I do think it's a little far-fetched that England would be running this whole operation. One of their intelligence. I was like, oh, okay. Anyway, I think that just while we're still talking about chaotic eras yeah. and stable eras, I absolutely loved the visual of Jin yeah. moving around the candelabras mm-hmm. and to describe the three bodies. I thought that yeah. was so cool, and it was such a tangible way to understand this problem, because again, this was something I definitely googled in the book. I was like, what are y'all talking about, three suns? Yeah. Like, what are we yeah, even yeah. doing here?
Yeah, I really like that. I really love it. I really love, I love that. I'll be honest, you know, I don't want to get too meta, but listen, this means a lot coming from me, because anyone who's a fan of the show or knows me in real life knows that I dunk on Benioff and Weiss at every single chance I get. So I'm going to say that when they have content to adapt, they're pretty damn good. When they have the actual content, when the content exists, this is decent. I really like how they visually are telling this story. Like, you know what I mean? I do.
So you want to just sub George?
I mean,
George R. R. Martin just taking one on the chin.
I mean, definitely finish the books. I don't think it's an accident that that there's a book in this book that has to do with spring that they bring up. I don't think it's an accident. I think they're a little salty. They and that the theme is we can't save ourselves. Somebody else better come and save us. Like that's you know, these guys had some trauma. You know what I mean? They're working it out. They're working it out through their art. So God bless them. You know, like I don't think it's. I listen. This could be a 2-hour episode within itself if I go off into all the problems that I think with Game of Thrones and these guys. But what I will say is this. I do think that they're doing a good job so far in the first 4 episodes that we're covering. I have not seen the next 4 yet, so I will see. But so far, so good. So far, so good. And you know, I was kind of like, when you were like, we should cover this, I was like, so I went kicking and screaming. And then, you know, you were like, no, we should really cover this. You should read it. And I started reading the book, and I was like, wow, the book's pretty good. And the show has really helped. And they're really good at fixing issues with source material that you couldn't imagine visually. I really couldn't imagine, like you said, dehydration. And I thought they did that really well. I thought the video game world has done really well.
Yeah, I agree. I was having a lot of trouble understanding this video game world. And I think even like the pyramid,
yeah,
that scene, I think is in episode 2. I was like, wait, like an actual pyramid, like, you know, they're mm-hmm. asking you to visualize stuff from history that, like, I've never really thought about visualizing before. So I thought that was really dope. And The book is very sciencey, and I often, as I was reading it, I had several conversations with friends saying, I find some of this inaccessible. Mm-hmm. Because as a reader, it's very frustrating to read things that you don't understand fully. Mm-hmm. And I like that they included the relevant science, but they didn't get too, they didn't get too much in the weeds. Like the scene from episode 3 in the game with the computer was super confusing in the book. I had no idea what was actually happening, and I thought they made it super clear. Like, I actually said, oh, like when all three I almost said Moon's sons were in this Syzygy, like I was like, oh, okay, and now I get what was happening. So I thought it was done really well. And I think there are other things that they did really well. There's things I'm not crazy about, but I'm going to save most of that for the next 4 episodes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that one of the things you spoke about was, and we were talking, you mentioned was about, will the voiceover that happens when Will gets his diagnosis.
Yeah, like, this feels like foreshadowing too, right?
Yeah, it does.
I don't know what it means though, because I didn't read far enough. I'm like, so Will gets this diagnosis for stage 4 pancreatic cancer, which is devastating. And I genuinely, when this happened, was like, why is this happening? It is explained later. Mm-hmm. So everyone just put a pin in Will. He like it will come. It's important later. However, the voiceover of him talking to the students about the potential for a multiverse, it cannot be an accident that this voiceover is happening rather than us hearing his actual diagnosis. And it, the notion that consciousness could exist in many other worlds, I was like, okay, I'm putting a line under that. Are we going into some kind of multiverse? You know, you and I are very familiar with multiverses at this point.
Yeah.
We've covered multiple properties in that multiverse. We got His Dark Materials, The Witcher. So I don't know if this is going to bear any fruit, but I do feel like this was foreshadowing that when we see future episodes, this will come back up.
Well, I definitely think it's foreshadowing, and I definitely feel like, from my perspective, you know, esotericism, mysticism, science, this is a conversation that happens super often, and quantum mechanics, and I often think that, I just think that this is part of what he's wrestling with, I think, in the beginning with the opening scene. When we were just talking about like the Big Bang and it opens up the idea when you said of something existing before. Well, there's a school of thought in mysticism that thing is like unknowable consciousness that like actually creates multiple worlds and like or in some places we'll call it the all or nothing. And out of that void sprang the universe, and out of that void sprang other universes. And that there's some way, somehow, a different version of us or a different version of someone else that is like us in these other worlds. And that's like a theory that kind of crosses science and mysticism in an interesting way that I think he's wrestling with and hinting at. You know, I think it comes up in quantum mechanics and physics, and then it comes up really clearly in Western mysticism, Eastern mysticism, this idea of a great consciousness that spans beyond our world, that is unknowable and has each of us having a spark and connective tissue to it. And I think that's what he's wrestling with. That's the foreshadowing I'm hearing him wrestle with. Let's see if he gets there, if he lands the plane.
Yeah, I don't know, because again, I didn't complete all of the homework reading before this show came out, which I have big regrets about. Just for our listeners who do want to read the books, if you have not watched the final 4 episodes, they will definitely spoil book 2 for you. So if you've read book 1 like me, but like we're way beyond book one in the end of this season. But I think you're right about wrestling with that. There's so many points of tension between what the scientists believe to be unbelievable and what we know to be true. And I found the whole moment with the I Ching to be like, what is even, like, why are we doing this? And I think it was sort of this moment of like, science can be fanaticism too.
Science can be fanaticism as well. And that's what I think, especially with the writer being a scientist, like computer scientist, this makes sense. And if he has, you find this thing you have to make peace with, you know, when you work in tech, science, whatever it is, when you have these people who are just strictly that way versus like a person who you may, and I think, I don't know what Einstein's beliefs were. I'm not that versed in it, but I do believe there are a lot of scientists that kind of also have a belief in a higher power or some sort of mystic belief or divination, which inspires their exploration into the natural world. And I think like there's like these divides in these communities, right? That there's fanaticism, I think, in both of them. And I thought the I Ching was fascinating for a couple of reasons. One, because we've explored it before on this show in multiple shows. We've explored it now in this one, in His Dark Materials, and there were hints of it in Lovecraft Country. And I think the idea of divination being something that is unfounded by science, but that a lot of times science ends up proving things that the ancients have said through divination is a fascinating concept to wrestle with. I thought that was really cool to see in the show. So
yeah, and the game kind of confirms that, like, the solution to the three body problem should be based in science. However, there is no solution to the three body problem, and then they want the scientists playing this game to base their solution in something else, which is the moral, like, absolute that these people on this planet deserve to live.
Yeah.
Which kind of is contrary to, like, a lot of evolutionary thinking of scientists, right? Which is sort of like, these people deserve to live for what reason? Like, their environment is trying to kill them. And that probably happens in science, like in space, all the time, right?
Yeah.
Civilizations may have come and gone or never gotten off the ground because the conditions were not right. And so I think that the show and the story is trying to wrestle with some of these, like, beliefs, right? Yeah. Like, obviously science is based in observation and observing facts, but there's also a set of beliefs that you have in order to believe, like, to follow science. And so I think it's wrestling with a little bit of that as well.
Yeah, and I mean, Saul sums up that fanaticism when he says, you know, that something that can't be explained is, it must be bullshit. Or, you know,
for a scientist to say. Like, what?
Yeah, he's basically thinking it's a scam. If science can't explain it, then it's a scam. But then I found that his character fascinating that way, because they all kind of looked at him for certain answers. There was a point where all of them kind of deferred to him because he's the most, like, practical, like, thinker inside of Jack's house. And I kind of thought, like, yeah, but, like, a lot of scientists, there's some scientists falling that way, but a lot of scientists I've known in my life, like, they're visionary. Like, they want to know, the things they can't explain, they want to figure out. You know what I mean? They don't just out and out call it bullshit. So I find his point of view more of a statement about him than all science. You know what I mean? But it's an interesting viewpoint, because I think it's going to play out normally people who start out there end up having some epiphany throughout a show. You know what I mean?
You have to have the belief that something could be out in space in order to want to send messages to space.
Yeah.
Agreed. Like, look how game Jay is when she has the opportunity to be part of the Red Coast base and have this mission of communicating in space. She's like, I'm all for it, which means that she has to have the possibility to believe in something that hasn't been proven, that we don't know, that could just all be bullshit.
Yeah.
And so Saul and Jack being so dismissive was kind of weird to me. I think that like Jack had served his purpose in the show, and so that's why he was dispatched with.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think you're right that this will come back for Saul later. Like, what is too unbelievable to be like, what should be dismissed? What should we say? Okay, wait, maybe we can find an explanation for it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there's some interesting takes in here. One consistent theme that I think we keep finding in all the things that we're covering is how past trauma affects characters. And I mean, we have seen this in a lot of the shows that we've been covering, and it's shown up again in both the main and the minor characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that we get, even from Tatiana, the woman who is working for the Santee's followers, mm-hmm. who kills Jack. We get this scene with her and Dashi where she is talking about how her father was shot in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And we also get a scene, I believe, of her and Jin, where she's telling Jin that she didn't have anything before she came to this movement. Mm-hmm. I think that it's really interesting how trauma is being used to kind of demonstrate that trauma doesn't stop, that it continues to ripple out through society. And I was thinking about this just in terms of like the generational trauma that must have been experienced after the Cultural Revolution,
mm-hmm.
and that must be reverberating through Chinese culture today. I'm saying must be because I don't know, you know, I don't, mm-hmm. I want to be respectful of people who experience this or may have had relatives who experienced it and ancestors who experienced it. But my guess is that it's still felt. And it made me think of a book I read that actually dealt with generational trauma in Japan after World War II called A Tale from the Time Being, and how the fallout of that trauma, the experience of being part of something so so grand on a historical level continued to reverberate even through people who didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like people who had been born after it and never learned about it. And I think mm-hmm. about that too when I think about like how 9/11 affected our culture. And so I think that the story is trying to show us how trauma reverberates through our society even years after it's happened, and even after the people who were primarily affected by it are gone, because we're talking about the potential here for a 400-year conflict, because yeah. one woman made a choice, and she made that choice based on the trauma she experienced as a very young woman.
Yeah.
And that could have potentially, well, I mean, I think the story is telling us that did change the fate of humanity. So I think it's giving me a lot to kind of think about in a way that I don't think I had sat with the book and reflected on that theme that much. I think in the book I was reflecting more on the sort of like, what do you do about this moral this moral problem that you have where you have a people from another planet who are suffering, but now they want your planet. And what do you do? What is the right thing to do in this situation? To try to negotiate, to try to fight back? Like, what do you try to do here? And the fact that one young woman set this all off because she had lost her family. Mm-hmm. is a really profound thing to consider. And also, in my opinion, entirely believable.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree that it's believable. And I find some of the symbolism to be fascinating. I mean, like, you think about some of the symbolism about, you know, people coming to another world or the new world and trying to, like, you know, and needing the resources that people who are already living there have, and being willing to, like, do what they need to do to be able to take over that world. Like, all of that is, like, pretty sound. If you were not talking about aliens and all these other things, you would think, oh, this sounds like American history, right? Like, there's, mm-hmm. like, a lot of things, or world history, right, where we've seen this multiple times where, you know, trauma, when we talk about, like, you know, generational trauma, they're saying 400 years. And I just think, well, 400 years ago, like, you know, on my father's side of my family, four generations back, somebody was probably a slave. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so it's not really that far-fetched that, you know, four generations ahead, that they'll be in the midst of a battle, you know what I mean, with, like, their great-great-great-grandchildren fighting to try to keep the world from being taken over by these aliens, you know? Like, so it's very fascinating to think about. And that, you know, or far-fetched that, you know, this level of, like, shared trauma we have from these catastrophic world events that we sometimes don't even talk about. Like, I find it fascinating personally. You know, people have talked about it on podcasts and all that stuff, but there's not a whole lot of, like, visual films or content that talks about even what we lived through 3 years ago in the pandemic, right? It's, like, kind of 4 years ago now. Like, it's kind of like they just kind of moved on. Documentary, sure, but, like, a narrative film?
So, interestingly, England just had a television miniseries about this, and it is getting pretty good reviews. And
yeah.
And it wasn't until the reason I noted it was because of another property that we have covered, Downton Abbey. One of the main characters from Downton Abbey, not Laura Carmichael, the actress who plays Anna. Mm-hmm. Is the star of this series, and it made me realize, you're right, there's so little film about something that happened very recently. And I think about that as well with Hurricane Katrina. There's mm-hmm. like not that much film mm-hmm. about the one of the most devastating events in my young adulthood.
Yeah,
there's not that many films about 9/11, even though it had this huge impact on just how we even live our day-to-day lives. We don't unpack the trauma, and I think that because we don't unpack it often, it lives on and it takes on a life of its own. And I think that is part of the storytelling here, which is we, every single character that we know from this story, has told some kind of story of trauma, except for Jack and Saul. And Saul haven't given us one, but that doesn't mean that Saul won't. But we know that something horrible happened to Jin's parents. They died in a flood. We know that something terrible happened to Augie at one point. We know that Dashi's wife died. Like, we just have all these stories, and I think that they're all going to matter, and maybe not in the particulars, but they'll matter in some way in the decisions that the characters make.
Yeah, for sure. You know who's not afraid to unpack trauma?
Oh.
Raj's dad.
It's like, we're having a very relaxing dinner. Let me tell you how I killed a bunch of Pakistani soldiers.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know. What was the point of him telling that story? I was like, holy crap. It's got to have some meaning later on.
Yeah, sure. That's why I, like, noted it. Because I was like, this story doesn't fit in anywhere in this moment even. But it's got to be important. And I wonder if it'll be more important for Raj than it is for Raj and Jin than it is for the story overall. But clearly they were trying to tell us something with this story.
For sure.
Because who does that?
No, definitely not. I'm rooting for Raj and Jin like I was rooting for Korra and Mako. Like, I really am not. I just am not. Don't ship it. Don't care. Don't want it to go down.
They're not a good match. I like Raj, actually, but they're just not a good match.
Yeah,
like,
me too.
These are two people who shouldn't be together. But the story that his dad tells about basically playing dead on this mountainside and killing all of the Pakistani. And he tells it like he's proud of, like he's proud of this. This is like a thing that mm-hmm. he did that he's very proud of. And the fact that he's proud of it just made me take away the theme of like, they're trying to tell us that at some point there's going to be a storyline where sacrifices must be made.
Yeah. Or, and also like that they need to play, you know, maybe they'll need to play possum and act as if they're defeated in order to actually win. You know what I mean? Like, so, and you know, again, back to the mysticism versus science, like it, like there's a lot of people who, at least in the mystic traditions, like talk about like, you know, sacrificing being like the way of transmutation, like the way to like actually make something materialize, right? Like that there's like no you can't have one, you have to give something up in order to get something in return, right? Like you can't like have it all, as everybody says. And so like maybe he's kind of telling them a story about that. You can't have it all, like you gotta like figure it out, you gotta like, you know, sometimes play possum. It's a very stark and dark way to just say, hey, you know what guys, you can't have it all, you gotta do this. One time I did like, you know, something cool and whatever is one story, but like, you can't have it all. I murked a bunch of people on top of a mountain to get water. That's kind of fucking crazy. It was a wild,
Well, to get oxygen. But yeah, I think what he was trying to say, or what we're supposed to take from it, is that in order to survive, for his men to survive, he had to do something horrible, but then it changed the whole fate of the war. And so I was like, okay, noted, sir.
I will note this.
That at some point, our characters may be faced with a situation where they have to make a sacrifice that makes them feel terrible and is does something morally wrong, but that they have to do it because they don't have a choice. It's either that or death.
Yeah, for sure.
And then it changes the fate of the conflict. We'll see. I mean, right now, this is not much of a conflict, right? It just seems like Earth is getting its ass whooped by the Santee because they're out here making our stars blink at us. Like, it's not.
And the scientists are like, forget this, I'm checking out. You know
right.
what I mean?
Like it's like, not, maybe. Not like a, you know. It's not like a thing where I think we're evenly matched here. I think it's pretty clear that they are winning, because they knew there was a conflict before we even knew. So there's that too.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's still, I know we're getting close here to ending, but it's still kind of unclear to me also why they're attacking the scientific community, right? Like I would, at this point in the story, I'm still trying to figure that piece of it out. You know, like what the hell is the point? Like why don't you want her to do nanotechnology? Why don't you want these scientists to live? It's kind of, yeah, it's just weird. So I
think what's not clear at this point, and I'm still like, I'm speculating here because I don't know, or if this was revealed in the book, I don't remember. But I think most of the scientists are also getting these countdowns.
Yeah.
And are doing what Augie like had, like they're refusing, unlike Augie.
Yeah. The detective also said that some of them quit and don't, either they end up like your friend or they end up not, or quitting their job. Like
he did say that.
Yeah.
So yeah, and like Vera, her project had already been shut down. So I think there is still some confusion, still some mystery around like what's going on with the scientists. But there's a lot of mystery about like how are the Santee actually doing what they're doing?
Yeah, for sure. Well, maybe we'll have some more answers to those questions and others ourselves and for you all. Thank you so much for joining us. We are happy to be exploring the world of Three Body Problem, which is really our world, but with aliens. Mm-hmm. And just it's exciting. It's exciting to be doing a sci-fi show. So if you want to get in touch with us, have any thoughts, reach out to us at Kin Folklore Pod on Instagram, Kin Folklore Pod on X, Also, you can hit us up on kinfolklore@gmail.com, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.